28. The most difficult thing about translating from one language into another is the tempo of its style, which is rooted in the character of the race, physiologically speaking, in the average tempo of its metabolism. There are honestly intended translations which, as involuntarily coarse versions of the original, are almost misrepresentations, simply because its brave and cheerful tempo, which springs over and neutralizes everything dangerous in things and words, cannot be translated. A German is almost incapable of presto, quick tempo, in his language, and thus, as you can reasonably infer, is also incapable of many of the most delightful and most daring nuances of free and free-spirited thinking, just as the buffoon and satyr are foreign to him in body and conscience, so Aristophanes and Petronius are untranslatable for him. Everything solemn, slow-moving, ceremonially massive, all lengthy and boring varieties in style, are developed among the Germans in a lavish diversity. You must forgive me for the fact that even Goethe's prose, with its mixture of stiffness and daintiness, is no exception, as a mirror image of the good old time to which it belongs, and as an expression of German taste at a time when there still was a German taste, a Rococo taste in moribus et artibus, in customs and the arts. Lessing is an exception, thanks to his play-actor's nature, which understood a great deal and knew how to do many things. He was not the translator of Bale for nothing, and was happy to take refuge in Diderot's or Voltaire's company, and even happier among the Roman writers of comic drama. In tempo, Lessing also loved free-spiritedness, the flight from Germany. But how could the German language, even in the prose of a Lessing, imitate the tempo of Machiavelli, who in his Prince allows one to breathe the fine dry air of Florence, and cannot help presenting the most serious affairs in a boisterous allegrissimo, very quick tempo, perhaps not without a malicious artistic feeling about what a contrast he was risking, long, difficult, hard, dangerous ideas, and a galloping tempo in the very best, most high-spirited of moods. Finally, who could even dare a German translation of Petronius, who was the master of the presto, more so than any great musician so far, in invention, ideas, words? Ultimately, what is so important about all the swamps of the sick, nasty world, even the ancient world, when someone like him has feet of wind, drive and breath, the liberating scorn of a wind which makes everything healthy, as he makes everything run? And so far as Aristophanes is concerned, that transfiguring, complementary spirit for whose sake we excuse all Hellenism for having existed, provided that we have understood in all profundity everything that needs to be forgiven and transfigured, I don't know what allows me imaginatively to explore Plato's secrecy and sphinx-like nature more than that petit fait, small fact, which fortunately has been preserved, that under the pillow on his deathbed, people found no Bible, nothing Egyptian, Pythagorean, or Platonic, but something by Aristophanes. How could even a Plato have endured life, a Greek life, to which he said no, without an Aristophanes? 29. It's the business of very few people to be independent. That is a right of the strong. And whoever attempts it, even with the best right to it, but without being compelled to, shows by that action that he is probably not only strong, but exuberantly daring. He is entering a labyrinth. He is increasing a thousandfold the dangers which life already brings with it, not the least of which is the fact that no one's eyes see how and where he goes astray, gets isolated, and is torn to pieces by some cavern-dwelling minotaur of conscience. Suppose such a person comes to a bad end, that happens so far away from men's understanding that they feel nothing and have no sympathy, and he cannot go back any more. He cannot even go back to human pity. 30. Our loftiest insights must and should ring out like foolishness under some circumstances like crimes, when in some forbidden way they come to the ears of those for whom they are not suitable and who are not predestined to hear them. The exoteric and the esoteric views, as people earlier differentiated them among philosophers, with Indians as with Greeks, Persians and Muslims, in short, wherever people believed in a hierarchy and not in equality and equal rights, this differentiation does not arise so much from the fact that the exoteric view stands outside and looks, assesses, measures and judges from the outside, not from the inside. The more essential point is that the exoteric view sees the matter looking up from underneath, but the esoteric sees it looking down from above. There are heights of the soul viewed from which even tragedy ceases to work its tragic effect. And if we gathered all the sorrow of the world into one sorrow, who could dare to decide if a glance at it would necessarily seduce and compel us to pity, and thus to a doubling of that sorrow? What serves the higher kind of men as nourishment or refreshment must be almost poison to a very different and lower kind of man. The virtues of the common man will perhaps amount to vices and weaknesses in a philosopher. It could be the case that a higher kind of person, if he is degenerating and nearing his end, only then acquires characteristics for whose sake people in the lower world into which he has sunk find it necessary to honour him as a saint from now on. There are books which have an opposite value for the soul and for health, depending on whether the lower soul, the lower vitality, or the higher and more powerful soul makes use of them. With the first group, the books are dangerous, shattering, disintegrating. With the second group, they are a herald summons which provokes the bravest to show their courage. Books for the whole world always smell foul. The stink of small people clings to them. Where the folk eat and drink, even where they worship, the place usually stinks. One shouldn't go into churches if one wants to breathe clean air.